Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Zombie Myths of Australian Military History, Chapter 2, Breaker Morant, The Murderer as Martyr by Craig Wilcox, this particular chapter. And we're up to page 29 of this 250-page book, so hopefully we'll get through to it. Now, the important thing is that few people would, or a lot of people are challenged to pick Australia on the map, and then occupation history, it's pretty much a revelation. This is sort of obscure history. Everyone in Australia knows Breaker Morant because there's movies and films and stories about him. And we also know that the stories aren't necessarily true. There's a different side to it. But from the outside world, few people would know of this particular person. So he's really a person, an Australian person, whose history has to be told and untold. And the interest, I suppose, from the outside world is how a figure can be achieve national fame but not really deserve it. It may have application for a figure in your culture. Exiled to colonial Australia, the wild young son of an English admiral surpasses even the most hard-bitten bushman at riding and rollicking. Under the nom de plume, the Breaker, he submits 60 or more bracing poems to the irrelevant New Bulletin magazine. So there's a fairly famous magazine, I think it used to be monthly magazine, called the Bulletin. And however, about 20 years ago, it's had its last publication. It was a beautiful magazine. He breaks hearts as well as horses, including that of Daisy Bates. But he drinks too hard, presumes too often on his friends, and yearns to return home. A war in South Africa gives him the chance to earn his honour that he might please his stern father, joining thousands of other Australians who reinforce the bungling British Army. He rises as the head of a detachment of crack Bushveld carbineers, the SAS before their time, who turn the tables on the Boers and help them turn the tide of the British Empire. They do so with methods that hardly seem honourable to civilians back home, but killing more than a dozen prisoners in their custody is an understandable response to the outrages committed by the Boers, such as wearing British khaki, and one being taken by plenty of others in the army. Nor do these killings really matter when weighed against the barbarities perpetuated by Horatio Kitchener, the cruel commander-in-chief and the inventor of concentration camps, who, in any case, may have given... Sorry, he's turning the page here. The Carbineers' secret orders to kill. If so, these orders are denied after a German pastor dies under the Carbineers' protection, and the army must find scapegoats to appease Berlin to demonstrate British fairness to the Boers. Thus does Harry Harbord Morant, poet and prodigal son, bushman and buccaneer, come to die at the hands of the British firing squad in Pretoria in February 1902, after braving telling its members to shoot straight, you bastards. The grave he shares with Peter Hancock, the blunt lieutenant from Bathurst, executed beside him, is a nagging reminder to Australians of the justice denied by British brass hats, of superior fighting ability of the men in slouch hats, of what battle is really like, and how high the price can be for fighting other people's wars. Or so the myth runs. For more than a century, Australians have told, reworked and retold, eventually introducing it to American and British audiences through the filmmaker Bruce Beaufort's masterpiece, Breaker Morant. But it remains at heart a cautionary fable for Australians, full of apparent truths about dirty wars and arrogant imperial dotards who drag native provincial nephews into them. It is especially useful as Australians look back on their experience of world wars, charted a new course after the collapse of the British Empire, and made sense of the defeat of Vietnam. For all its usefulness, though, the folk tale is remarkably baseless. Okay, so far is what Australians are fed on, and I would know very little from it. I actually played Lord Kitchener in a school play of Breaker Morant with Poppycock. useful reminder to the Hun that the British soldiers will stand form and close ranks when called up, when duty calls upon, or something like that. Harry Harbord Murat was, in a sense, an entirely fictional character. He was created by Ed Murat, no admiral's son, but the restless child of a couple who had run a workhouse in Somerset. A keen reader of adventure stories by the fox hunter and former guards officer, George White Melville. He even acquired the interest, outlook, and extravagant equine style of Melville's ruined spendthrifts and dashing dragoons, of whom Lord Cardigan of Light Brigade fame was an exemplar. It was Lord Cardigan, well, there you go. It was a short step from thinking like these men to pretending to be one of them. Murat. Oh, okay. So, he's Murat, Murat, M-U-R-R-A-N-T. Murat found no relatives or acquaintances in Australia to challenge the past he gradually crafted for himself. So he's actually not Morant. Breaker Murat. It's actually Murat, M-U-R-R-A-N-T. Well, there you go. His father was supposedly a clergyman before being promoted to admiral. Nor were the people he fell in with inclined to doubt his story or dismiss it as irrelevant. Colonial Australians must have been egalitarian in their rhetoric, but many were caste-conscious in reality. They respected good breeding as much as they admired hair-raising risk-taking, and both seemed equally typical of a drinker, drifter, and drover who styled himself as a horsebreaker, and who, before asking for a guinea or two, would casually let slip the supposed identity of his wealthy governor, and how an inheritance, or at least a down payment on it, would soon be coming his way. Well, so he's an absolute fraudster. My godfather. Sorry, I would just know that. So his name is not Morant, it's Murant. There you go. They were flattered by an outcast Britisher and turned Australian like themselves, as the bulletin purred, and without a single whore in his composition. Whore, whore, whore. The Breakers' verses owed something to Melville's equine ballads, something to poets imbibed at grammar school, and something to the writings of a real gentleman's son, whose wild and wasteful life was now it was over, was starting to intrigue Australians. If Harry Harbord Murat was born out of George Myrtle, White Myrtle, Melville's cheap novels, the life he lived in Australia was a parody of Adam Lindsay Gordon's novels. The Boer War, 1899 to 1902, was fought between the British Empire and two independent Boer republics, the Orange Free State and the Transvaal Republic. Well, there you go, that's a piece of information I didn't know, who would control South Africa. No medal, no mention of dispatches, no glowing reports to Australian newspapers suggest that Corporal Murat distinguished himself during the first of his two brief periods of service in this war. That the unknown NCO was plucked from the service first by a general and then by a famous war correspondent was widely attested after his death, but may owe something to the story spun. There is no evidence at all for the romantic legend that, between his two stints in uniform, he was received into the bosom of his admiral's family in Devon, at England, though family letters record their perplexity on being sent to Cape Town Hotel Bill he dodged. Okay, so he's a fraudster. He took leave somewhere in England on one occasion, passing himself as the son of Colonel Morant of Renmark in South Australia, was unlikely to have mingled with the admiral and his kin. In any case, being in the line of a temporary commission as a lieutenant in the newly raised Bushveld Carbineer was unlikely to have impressed a flag officer. Taking that commission was one small indication that the British Army needed experienced mounted troops in South Africa, but not of its inability to beat the Boers without colonial know-how. After predictable setbacks in the war, no less complex than later ones in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, the British Empire was learning to corral the Boers between blockhouses, barbed wire, armoured trains and mounted columns, and then sweep the land again and again until it seemed that every farm would be burnt, every hamlet levelled, every cow and sheep slaughtered, and that no choice facing the enemy would be imperial rule or destruction of their world. Under Kitchener, the army waged a brutal war, and into the concentration camps he copied from Spanish in Cuba. They were not Kitchener's invention. Well, there you go. Good God. So the concentration camps are from the Spanish in Cuba. The Spanish. Okay, we herded thousands of Boers into black civilians. Such camps were death traps at first, but the brutality had a cold reason behind it. It adhered to the codes that could be learned. It was directed by generals who answered to politicians back home. Those politicians answered in turn to electors. None of this was true of the killings by detachment of the Bushveld Carbineers. The Carbineers stationed around Fort Edward, a metal blockhouse 16 hours ride north of the regional capital of Pietersburg, began killing in July 1901 after the South African intelligence officer called Alfred Taylor learned that six Boers were approaching with their wagons and cattle. Taylor and James Robinson, the detachment commander officer, sent to patrol to kill them. Soon after speaking to some of the dead men's relatives, a Carbineer private called von Boren was shot dead while riding with Peter Hancock. Robinson recalled to Pietersburg where Robert Leon, a corpulent Australian who commanded the Carbineers, was based and replaced by Percy Hunt, an English chum of Morant. Morant and his own troop of Carbineers now joined the detachment, as did George Whitten, a lieutenant from Gippsland. Hunt was nearly killed in August while leading a raid on the farmhouse where the hostile Boers were sleeping. Hunt was nearly killed in August while leading a raid. His death and the stripping and possible mutilation of his body prompted Morant suddenly, the detachment senior officer, to raid another farmhouse and capture the wounded Boer called Visser, who, Morant insisted, was wearing some of Hunt's clothing. Visser, executed on the day of Morant's orders, began a bloody harrying of local Boers under Morant's direction and with Taylor's encouragement. "We've killed 13 of them up to date," Morant wrote to Lichten and Meadowwaters. Eight more deaths followed a week later when a group of Boers who surrendered to the Carbineers were shot dead the next day by Morant, Hancock, Whitten, and some rankers. Daniel Hess, a German-trained pastor, spoke to the eight in a leisurely interval between their capture and death. Like von Boren, Hess was found dead soon after. The final killings came early in September when Morant, Hancock, and Morant's soldiers servant shot dead a man and his two sons. Though too late to save these lives, the investigation would bring the detachment's officer to trial was already underway. Okay, so they alerted the British authorities. So Morant is a complete fraud. Morant. "I came here to shoot Boers, not to play," Morant snapped at the colleague, disgusted by what he'd done. "We're out fighting the Boers," he spluttered in court, "not sitting comfortably behind barbed wire entanglements. We've got them, and we shoot them under Rule 303. Whitten put it more mildly. "It was unfair," he pleaded, "to judge the participants by the hard and fast rules of citizen life or strict moral codes of peace. There was no disagreement from James Justice Thomas, the solicitor from Tenderfield and former officer of New South Wales contingents in the war, whom Lehan hired as defence counsel. War is war, and rough things have to be done," Thomas wrote to Whitten's father. "I say, the Boers deserve all they get, and with less nonsense sentiment, the war would be over." At the trial, he put an argument as brutal as this to the judges, while also urging them to consider practices adopted by other irregular corps against the enemy, breaking the usages of war and special orders given by to the Carbineers. Of all the Empire's fighting men, irregulars like the Carbineers were the most inclined to respond to real or imagined enemy atrocities by shooting captured Boer combatants. Army headquarters usually turned a blind eye to these practices, to use Thomas' word for them. Hence, a Provost Marshal's reaction to the news of the eight Boers' death, that if the Carbineers had intended to do this, they should not have accepted a surrender in the first place. Gee, that's strange. Presumably, the Provost Marshal did not yet know that Visser alone of the Carbineers' victims was an enemy combatant. Oh dear.
Hess and Van Buren obviously were not, and the group of six had decided to turn their backs on the now defect board administration and follow British instructions to hand over any rifles they possessed and sign an oath of loyalty to the Crown. Dear. Old Mr. Geyser was in the wagon sick, an English activist, as the English activist Emily Hobhouse later wrote, of the group of six. His son, a lad of 12, was with him, and Jan Glading and John Versil, also two others. The whole party had surrendered, were unarmed. The boy begged and prayed for them not to shoot him, but this was in vain. He was killed with the rest and told rest, and the old man in his wagon bed. Dear, that's bad. It's atrocities. Witten insisted that the only trigger he pulled against one of the eight Boers, a notorious scoundrel, and head of a band of marauders who rushed him. Ernest Hammett, the squadron sergeant major, endorsed Witten's account. Yet it reads like the same old yarn that another carbineer had heard too often, that they gripped the rifle and fired at our men, and in the melee all were shot, no casualties on our side. Since the killings were closer to random murder than any furtive custom of taking revenge in the battlefield prisoner, Thomas was probably compelled to argue Morant's claim of having acted on special orders and try to prove it in court. Lehan, not the prosecution, punched the first hole through the argument when insisting that he, the carpenter's commanding officer, had never heard of such orders. A second fatal blow was landed when Herbert Hamilton, Kitchener's military secretary and supposed author of the supposed author, denied having given them. Perhaps these men were simply saving their own skins. Lehan got away with humiliating reprimand and Hamilton rose to the command of the division. Why would Hamilton or Kitchener or anyone else at headquarters instruct one small detachment of the army to kill every man and every boy who wasn't British, along with the potential whistleblowers like Boren and Hess? The supposed orders surely were the origin in Kitchener's exhortations to the army in July 1901 to stamp out armed resistance as rapidly as possible and leave no living thing in a mobile column's way. The permission he gave to execute Boers had been deceptively wearing British uniforms. The proclamation said nothing about killing, though, and the permission to execute Boers in full khaki was granted only to senior officers and, in any case, issued after Vischer's death, not before. Taylor, a cruel, conniving man, might possibly have persuaded Robertson, Hunt, and Morant, and Kitchener's word had a hidden meaning. He might simply have lied to them to spark a killing spree for his own reasons, or for no reason at all. If so, it was a damning indictment of the three officers that took Taylor's word for it rather than the capable Lehan for confirmation. Only the very green and carbineer private Frank Hall said gave any credence to Taylor's urgings. Okay, isn't that amazing? Thomas's argument to the court for the need for rough measures in war was equally shaky. If these were called for in South Africa, Kitchener was already taking more than enough of them. But in fact, there was relatively little fighting around Fort Edward. The region was thinly populated. Mobile columns had already cleansed most of the area of opposition. Hence the carbineers' deployment. They were not elite soldiers, but rather a garrison force modelled on a more famous South African constabulary. Itself an adaptation, not of some military unit or other, but rather the Royal Irish Constabulary and the Canadian Mounties. Oh, wow. The carbineers' job was to protect loyalists and potential loyalists, not to shoot them down. If the few hostile Boers still at large really did threaten to capture and torture Taylor, as Taylor told the court, it was one indication that their weapons were dwindling to mere threats. Another was the carbineers' casualty list. Von Braun was the first among the regiment to die from a bullet. And if Hunt's body was indeed mutilated by some Boers after death or even before, it was Morant's responsibility as senior officer to control his own anguish and his men's anger, or absolute minimum, unleash these only in genuine battlefield prisoners. The real pressure on Ford Edward's occupants came not from the Boer resistance, but from threats to Taylor, or from how Hunt died, but from the inexperience and corruptibility of the officers, and opportunities since taken for looting, drinking, cattle rustling, and finally killing the defenceless. The court martials were the greatest farces ever enacted outside a theatre, Gooden complained after the trial ended. Not in the mercy generally recommended by the judges, but in a life sentence for him and death sentences from Rant and Hancock. None of the accused had sufficient time to prepare the case with Thomas before the trial. Much of the testimony came from soldiers who held grudges against Marat, or from Robinson or Hammett in their return for immunity. The departure from South Africa of the regional commander before the trial may have prejudiced the accused, though it was the prosecution rather than the defence who were embarrassed by it at the time. Picton, an English lieutenant in the detachment, was merely cashiered for his part in the killings. That's chucked out of the army. Lehan escaped lightly too, and Taylor evaded any punishment at all. These were damning indictments against the tribunal, but they did little to determine its verdict. Except for the Hess case, where no witness could be found, the killings could not be denied. Thomas's argument of following custom and following orders were contradictory. In his inexperience and perhaps the emotional burden he carried from his own disappointment as soldiers and grievances against the army hardly helped the accused. It did not occur to him, as it occurred to Marat's later champion, to argue that the defendant's part in repelling the Boer raid during the trial constitute a condemnation that might be brought them pardons. So this is the entire thing that the court came under fire from the Boers, and Marat was given a gun to defend. But he was quick to interpret the sentence given to Marat, Hancock and Witten as a consequence of Germans' pressure to punish Hess's killer. No one told him that the German foreign minister had signalled his government's lack of interest in the case. Plenty of Australians shared the lack of interest. The execution of two officers seems a sensational event. The official failure to notify Hancock's widow, a bad taste for many months, and Witten's incarceration in a English military prison gradually roused a storm of protest. But the few federal government, let's read the page, but the new federal government that now spoke for Australians within the British Empire had no jurisdiction over irregular soldiers who were stateless auxiliaries recruited at the front and paid by the army itself. Nor did the government lament the lack of jurisdiction once Kitchener assured it that no circumstances had justified what the Carpiniers had done. His assurance was buttressed by newspapers' interviews with the former Carpiniers, who affirmed that the sensational reports about the killings were all too true. Indeed, the more black deeds yet have to be disclosed. As the reports piled up, as each interview revealed blacker deeds than the last, most readers seemed to have concluded that Marat and Hancock had deserved to die. A journalistic spotlight even threatened to expose the real Marat. A New Zealand magazine laughed at how the man had sailed under the false colours all the time he was in Australia, passed himself off as the son of Admiral, and told the story of a quarrel with a stern parent. The Charters Towers Northern Miner identified the impostor as Ed Marat, a crook and con man who once lived in the town. The spotlight flickered briefly. The war, now mostly over, was already being forgotten. So too, within a few years, was the popular conclusion that justice had been more or less done with the Bushveld Carpiniers affair. In any case, the truth about Marat and his deeds was far less amusing as comforting as the folk tale, with its compelling hero, that Australians would eventually weave into the Bushveld Carpiniers affair to assure themselves that the fading British Empire was a good thing after all, that, and helping to fight the controversial imperial wars that might be naive, but not responsible for their consequences. Okay, so the British Empire is going, we need an exit story that the British Empire is corrupt and knocking us away. A largely frictional creation anyway, Harry Harbord Marat was too good a character to leave in his grave. The gentleman barbarian, with a bottle in one saddlebag and a cheap edition of Byron in the other, the outcast English heir who embraced the fresh bush life that was now passing, the wild rider who seemed all the wilder, now horses and horsemanship were on their way out too. The woman I had perhaps enough to bed and wed young Daisy Bates, and ruthless enough to cast aside the avenger who hunted down bandits, who murdered his friend Percy Hunt, the true mate who told the judges that Hancock had merely followed orders. The victim, who looked his executioner in the eye and bade them shoot straight. These were star recruits for growing antipodean pantheon of the good bad men, or the bad good men, as one of Morant's hagiographers came to see. Like the bush ranger Ned Kelly, Morant's bad luck and hard life, his insolence towards authority, his nonchalance toward death, had the potential to transform this criminal act into a heroic rebellion and his punishment into martyrdom. But a rampaging soldier who apparently scorned the rules, daring to dominate his little patch of enemy territory without remorse, was especially attractive in the coming age of total war and flirtation with naked force. Morant had died as a strong man dies, the bulletin contributed proposed, having exposed efforts to wage war according to the rule book as pulling a snivel of a weak-kneed fools. The first novel about his life, published in 1911, celebrated the sense of power of a strong man once, and may deserve, according to its author, had Australia turned away from the British Empire as sharply, sharply to the right in the 1930s, Morant might have become an official hero. But apart from a few writers and other cranks, Australians aren't much inclined to worship power. Morant would become, to conjure up in most minds, simply a scamp and a scapegrace, perhaps a scoundrel, all above a scapegoat. If most Australians concluded in 1902 that Morant and Hancock had earned their end, there were murmurs in the defence, encouraged by a common misconception that the parties of 6, 8 and 3 Boers were deceptively warring khaki, had been captured in battle or soon after it. One murmur rose to a shout that would echo for a century. Uneasy about the Empire and the Boer War, and in mourning for the roguish former contributor to the Bulletin, swallowed the assurance of Leanne that Morant and Hancock were fine soldiers, and from Thomas that killing prisoners was so routine in South Africa that it would hardly warrant punishment. The war had been wicked, the magazine said, but no Australian was to blame for that, not even one who broke the boundaries of morality. The real villains' reasons were those guilty and criminal, careless and sanguinarily designed, letting men like the Carpineers loose on the Boers' Kitchener, in other words, the military imperial establishment he represented. Our only fault, the Bulletin snarled in April 1902, at those who ran the British Empire, the British Army and British Empire, quote, is that we interpreted your instructions liberally, end quote. So shaming the establishment and the brass hats and the top hats had to turn on Morant and Hancock to save their reputations. Shot the scapegoats became the magazine's summary of their fate. The summary shaped the insider's account that would eventually lodge the affair in folk memory. The account was penned by Witten, or at least compiled by him, released from jail in the wake of protests across South Africa as well as Australia, that a young man from a good home had merely followed Morant's instructions, was denied a pardon and compensation. So he put his case in writing, building apologia around the trial documents, subsequently lost and dreams of advice from the Bulletin's literary editor. Published in 1907, Scapegoats of the Empire evoked a kangaroo court that sent a few officers to the scaffold to atone for the entire army's doing, with the commander's convenience. Though Witten was keen for generations of purging and educating and civilising when it came to the Boers, the real enemies of his book were the British officers and Berlin, the latter retrospectively credible foe now in collision between the British and German Empire seem imminent. Selective quotes from the trial documents, Witten's omission of the description of one of the Carpineers' victims as a boy aged 17 was typical. Lent credibility to a poor piece of writing, but a subtle piece of propaganda. My book is going off very well, he declared after publication. It was an exaggeration. The Australians were gearing for war with Germany, perhaps, and Japan too, and less time with Witten had hoped for whispering against the British brass hats. Still, the Bulletin's words and Witten's books lay waiting for their moment. The moment came a generation later, as Australians were taking stock of the wake of two world wars and the retreat of the British Empire. They were proud of their slouch-hatted soldiers had done in the battlefields of the Middle East and Western Europe and South Pacific. but stung by the irritations inherent when the auxiliaries joined the imperial armies commanded by metropolitan generals, condensation from metropolitan troops, and casualties in campaigns that were sometimes mishandled. Now the empire was gone, Australia was remaking itself politically as a post-colonial nation with ethnically a post-British one. Australians were inclined to imagine themselves as having been misused by the imperial establishment, perhaps of having been victims of the empire rather than privileged provincial members of it. A bloody war of independence from Britain began, fought on the cultural front against an unresisting, indeed moribund, enemy. One of the war's key campaigns was the struggle for collective memory of wars fought in Kharki. It ended in a resounding victory. Defeats such as Gallipoli and Singapore came to be interpreted in magazines, novels and films as a consequence of British bastardry, even British betrayal. This new nationalist narrative needed human faces. So what's going on here? Simpson's Kirkpatrick, this is Simpson and his donkey. So there's a story of a Gallipoli medic who used to take out Australian people on his donkey. So it says Simpson Kirkpatrick of donkey fame was too generically self-sacrificing to be useful. General Gordon Bennett, who clashed with British superiors on Singapore, was too easily accused of having run for his life when the island fell to the Japanese. A better candidate was spied in the late 1950s and early 1960s through the starstruck eyes of Frederick Cutlake, who, as a teenager three quarters of a century early, had met the idolized drifter and drunkard calling himself Harry Murat. Now, after a career encompassing service on the Western Front and sympathy for secret armies in the 20s and 30s, Cutler sat down to celebrate the man he left. He felt knew better than anyone else who had been unjustly forgotten. After failing to find the original trial documents and attributing the failure to official cover-up, Cutler imbibed the worst of what the Bulletin and Witten had written, added his own wild speculation, concocted a parable about a heroic horseman and a prodigal son, along with other heroes of the regiment. Elite Australians, given special rules never to take prisoners, were betrayed by incompetent and envious British colleagues. Cutler's Break of Morant accorded so perfectly with the emerging collective memory of Kharki conflicts that sold numbers Witten never knew and received as factual even by educated Australians. A few South Africans were even taken in. I have just read it with great interest and pity for the unfortunate subject, one wrote back. To Cutler's publisher, a truly scapegoat of the empire. Morant was suddenly a folk hero, and the Bushveld Carbineers began to be counted in the debated clubs and pubs across Australia. Cutler was born in England and had retired there. He had written this book in Sussex, embracing the folk tale about an Englishman who became more Australian than Australian-born, was one way a few British immigrants to enter the culture sceptical of them. But it was also true that the tale made sense to most English speakers. Many Britons and Americans were also fighting a cultural war against their old elites. Their old imperial strategic responsibility, the great armies that commandeered their menfolk from time to time. English filmmaker Tony Richardson, The Charge of the Light Brigade, 1968, was a cinematic adaptation of the subversive musical Oh, What a Lovely War, 1969. And a subversive musical. Were metropolitan demonic victories against an already waning enemy, but, unlike Cutler's book, they carried the spirit of a new, freer, more useful, more sceptical age. Kit Denton injected that spirit into the Morant folktale. A British soldier and broadcaster before reaching Australia, an eager Cutler for acceptance as one of the mob, in the full sense, Denton was struck by the universal veneration given to his adopted country to sight chats. Then he heard about Harry Murat in an Adelaide pub. He took it as truth, what he later realised was hearsay, rumour and speculation, worked it through his fertile mind, and once making a film was ruled out. Wrote a novel about the man who lived, wrote, fought and died pretty much the way I'd pictured. Denton, the Breaker, was a hero rather than anti-hero of the early 1970s. A sensitive soul, but savage in love and war, tragically let loose in the struggles without rules waged by incompetent army officer Duffs. Young Colonel Blimps, bloody-minded non-commissioned officer and big-hearted soldiers, or perhaps deliberately let loose by them, doing the dirty work they couldn't admit had to be done. One reviewer said that Denton's Morant as having paid with his life for the hypocrisy of those who pretended war can be civilized. That war was uncivilized. That war was uncivilized had now become an accepted fact. The Vietnam War, 59 to 75, was a dirty war fought against, was as dirty as a war fought against the Boer. The barbarities of Vietnam was most notorious massacre of the village of My Lai seemed bad enough to Australians as they absorbed the news of the fighting back home. Even worse was the humiliating defeat at the end of it. All Australians and Americans too had decided whether they'd stayed, they'd strayed from moral high ground and fought the wrong war in the wrong way for the wrong reasons. The Morant folktale, with its assurance that all war is barbarism and those in command are responsible for it, allowed the evasion of these hard questions of either blame it laid at the door of the generals and the politicians. For Australians, even more remote figures of an imperial elite. The tale also guided those who were wading through the contemporary platitudes of a growing pacifism to the astounding conclusion that if war was wicked and barbaric, as critics said, then murdering prisoners was no worse than shooting down enemy combatants in a fair fight. This conclusion clearly applauded by the comfortable audience in fashionable slacks and shawls when Melbourne playwright Kenneth Ross's Breaker Morant was performed in 1978. So I think I performed it in 1981. I did the play. Listen, Major, Ross Morant tells native James Francis Thomas, quote, "We did what we were, they asked. We fought, which means we killed. That's how you win wars, you know, even if those who declare wars forget that." The success of Ross's play steered Australian filmmaker, director Bruce Beresford towards making an increasingly popular folk tale. Beresford was more appalled by the darkness of Cutluck, Denton and Ross, and more alive to the incongruity and the contemplation offered by comforting lies. He was, therefore, more interested in the truth. Conducting his own research into the Bushville Carbineers affair and refusing to explain away the recent discovery of a letter in which Whitten admitted that Hancock had killed Hess. Still, Beresford was a brash young product of Australia and had fought for the British Empire before triumphantly turning against its ghost. For a generation convinced that armies of the former times consisted of lions led by donkeys or lambs led to the slaughter, and his family's whose memory of World War II included a private conviction that killing battlefield prisoners had been common. Its 1979 film, Breaker Morant, was intelligent and beautiful, and it placed some guilt with Morant, who was more boozy bore than glamorous bandit. Otherwise, it made an art out of the folktale. Usefully identified by smart slouch hats that none had worn in real life, Beresford, Morant, Hancock and Whitten and Thomas boldly take to the court a pith-helmeted British officer and their wicked puppet master Kitchener. The real heroes are Hancock, now a bluff digger, irresistible, a buff. We say bluff. I don't want to say bluff. We say buff. Dicker, irresistible woman, and Thomas, now a plucky champion of the uncomfortable truth that all war is barbarous. The slouch hats lose, of course, sacrificed to help the war and keep bullying on side. Thomas tells Hamilton to his face that the trial was a bloody sham, and Morant and Hancock die with their brave hearts and ironic smiles. Beresford's film joined Peter Weir's Gallipoli in advertising Australian men to the world as brilliant soldiers and great blokes to boot, capturing their manliness, comradeship and sardonic dignity, according to the writer Bob Ellis. It likewise painted them as unworldly ones, pawns in the hands of British generals and ripe for sacrifice. Quote, next time I go to a cricket match, one Australian spluttered after seeing the film, I'm going to throw my empty beer cans at the Poms. But the film sued as well as angered, conveying the folktale's assurance that the blame for anything Australians had done in the Boer War, and by inference Vietnam too, could comfortably be left at someone else's door. No wonder a Melbourne critic found it hard not to tumble out of the theatre in a state of hysterical glee when the film ended. One historian called the film an admirably honest. A British critic got it right, citing that one comes out of Mr. Beaufort's film sympathising with a man who shoots prisoners. Popular and profitable, Beaufort's film elevated Morant to the parody of Ned Kennedy as an Australian hero. It is true. Collections of... Morant's parody being published in one case illustrated by popular painter Pro Hart. Cutback's book entered Victoria's high school into its certificate syllabus, and not as a work of fiction. Tenfield began to celebrate Thomas as a notable son of the town who had defied the wicked Kitchener. The film introduced Morant and his easing of guilty collective consciousness of the British and American audience too, with some success. And even an episode of the popular television series The A-Team could flesh out the biography of a minor character by describing him as a lifer of the Bushveld Carbineers. It was different in South Africa, where another, and for all its own exaggerations, more believable folktale had risen about the black deeds of the Bushveld Carbineers. Arthur Davy, a Cape Town historian who sensed a duty to do justice to the dead, published a book of documents on the affair that included testimony of Carpentier's rankers against the officers and a memoir of the affair of Frederick Bertardou, an officer born and raised in Australia who had gathered evidence that set the trial in train and ultimately sent Morant and Hancock to their deaths. Davy published his book in time for the 1988 bicentennial of white settlement of Australia and hoped it would be noted in what, for a year or so, would be more than usually history-conscious country. He was wrong, but partly because few Australians themselves had begun chipping away at their own folk tale. Mark Carnegie, an art collector and amateur historian of private income, excellent taste and even better sense. Okay. Aided by Frank Shields, a documentary maker who got caught up with the Morant myth, she ferreted amongst the records in Australia, Britain and South Africa, and then announced the folk tale to be historical nonsense in a self-published book called In Search of the Bracken Morant. Carnegie and Shields concluded artlessly but accurately that Morant went crazy and took the law into his own hands. Why did they say artlessly? And that his nemesis was not much... so much Kitchener as the lawyer, the Australian, and his own unstable character. Their conclusion prompted Kick Denton to consciously repudiate his novel in a new book, Closed File. It also shaped pronouncements by three influential historians of the day. Russell Wall characterised the real Morant as an English confidence man. Manning Clark wrote of him as a liar, a thief, and a drunken scoundrel, and a believer of the rule of the fist, and a murderer of innocent people. And Beverly Kingston saw him only the ugly side of his frontier life. The educated were turning against the folktale. The new Boer War Gallery in the Australian Museum tolerated Morant rather than celebrated him. If South Australia's education minister called his name... for his name to be carved on Adelaide's Boer War Memorial, the official guardians of the Australian military memory refused to graft the legend onto the national military story that told and retold every Anzac Day and Remembrance Day. Within a decade, the folk tale was losing much of its popular appeal too. Australians had fought and won the Cultural War of the Independence of Britain and had shrugged off Vietnam too. There was less need for reassurance about the dirty wars. None at all now for making boogeymen of brass hats. Morant began to slip from public memory, though less so amongst the older generations. Hence, perhaps, in 1998, the decision of the Department's Veterans Affairs, increasingly hungry for affordable justice that might keep good opinions of the clientele, refurbish Morant and Hancock's grave. Oh dear. At the 11th hour, however, Morant found a new championship in the television documentary maker born 50 kilometres from Culloden. And inherently sceptical, he said, of the imperialist line. As the centenary of the affair approached, Nick Besniewski began to search for a project that he hoped would expunge Australia's original cringe about the Boer War and Morant Hancock's stain on the Anzac tradition and the National's otherwise impeccably war record. Like Denton before him, what was conceived as a piece of film was born at the end as a book. This time, part fiction and part based on research. Quote, "The war machine is the real enemy of the real enemy was the moral of shoot straight, you bastards. That unseen political, military, bureaucratic conspiracy that persuades ordinary men that it is noble to sacrifice themselves for nebulous concepts like the Empire, Lebensraum, and the Domino Theory." Belinsky's book sold well. A second edition appended legal arguments for the independence judicial review that should retrospectively squash the court martial verdicts. A bit weird, but I had to do that. The Empire, Lebensraum, and Domino Theory. A view might yet come, possibly even the retrospective pardon urged in late 1909 by Jim Uncles, a Royal Australian Navy lawyer. However, lukewarm initial reception to Uncles' urging suggests the folktale is continuing to fade. Still, it lingers in a few minds and resonates in many others. Bearfield's Breckenrand has entered the canon of Australian cinema. Of course, the Morant poetry, the fringe of the national literacy canon. But even without these props, the tale would speak to those Australians for whom the Bushman and the Bulletin contributor can't really have done much wrong for. If he did, could not have deserved to be executed. Perhaps the folk tale is merely dormant, awaiting a moment that will make it useful again, presumably in the wake of another dirty war in which casualties are heavy, civilians are killed, Australians disagree with metropolitan generals. For the moment, the tale lives on most prominently in the form of occasional reenactments of the Bushfilks Carpentier's trial, which has been documented by scholar Vivian Kelly. Despite her work on this and other aspects of the fable, a compliant Francis James Thomas remains pertinent. Quote, "The true story of the Bushfilk Carpentier's has never been told," he wrote to the newspaper 20 years after Morant and Hancock were executed, before adding wistfully, "Perhaps some days it will be." Okay, well, there you go.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.